This week on Behind the Lens, we'll talk with the reporter who broke our story about Hard Rock Hotel developers and their campaign donations to Mayor LaToya Cantrell. We'll also hear from Jules Bentley, author of a damning essay about the hotel's collapse. And Marta Jusen examines gifted education policy in New Orleans' charter school system. Some parents are upset about their limited options. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by Community Support. Learn more and support quality journalism today at thelensnola.org/donate. New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell faces growing anger over campaign contributions by the developers of the Hard Rock Hotel. Cantrell and her associated political action committee have collected about $70,000 in financial contributions from the partners of 1031 Canal Development, LLC. The hotel was under construction on October 12th when it collapsed, killing three workers and injuring dozens more. I spoke with Lens reporter Michael Isaac Stein about his investigation.
Michael, this is an investigation that had a huge draw on our website, thelensnola.org. Clearly a huge amount of interest in any ties between the Cantrell administration and the developers of the Hard Rock Hotel. Before you get into some of your findings, what prompted you and our editorial staff to take this track when other news outlets did not?
You know, what everyone's trying to figure out right now is exactly what's going on, you know, in conversations between the mayor and the developers of the Hard Rock Hotel. The demolition plans, for example, those are being planned out in consultation between the Cantrell administration and these developers, right? And we don't exactly know what's going on in that room. And these decisions come out that people question, and we don't exactly know the basis for all of these decisions because, again, there's a limit to how much information is being given out to the public. So really anything at this point that can get at the relationship between these developers and Cantrell administration is important right now. As to why we went after it when other, you know, outlets didn't, I can't really speak to that. I'm not even sure if that's true. Perhaps, you know that there's often stories that we're working on that we get beat to the punch on. So it happens to everybody. But it's something that we thought was important. And you know, we saw a lot of public calls for it, you know, and people wanted to know what that connection was and whether or not, you know, there's actually any influence going on from these public contributions. I think that's something that every New Orleans resident, you know, can decide for themselves. And so we figured, let's get the information out there.
Okay. And we discussed earlier that this is a relatively straightforward process, at least in terms of identifying reported campaign contributions to political officials and candidates for political office. So why don't you briefly explain to people exactly what that process entails?
Sure. Yeah, I think that's great. Because like you said, it actually is pretty straightforward. And so you start by, you know, looking at the developers themselves, right? And you know, you can go on, you know, Louisiana has an ethics page where you can look up campaign contributions by contributor, right? So you go on and you know, the first step there is, okay, well, you know, Citadel Builders, that's one of the developers. Let's plug in Citadel developers and see what that turns up. However, looking just at the names of the development companies is not going to give you everything you need.
Right.
So, you know, you have to look at all of the other LLCs that, you know, the partners, the executives at these companies, you know, have filed under their names. So what that process looks like, it's also, you know, pretty straightforward once you know the steps, but you can go on the Louisiana Secretary of State website. And you can look at all businesses that are on file in Louisiana, and you can search for those businesses by registered agents and officers on that business. So you can know who the business, whose name the business is actually in. Okay, so, you know, we took someone, Todd Trosclair. He is the CEO of All-Star Electric. And Todd Trosclair was one of the partners on the Hard Rock development team. So we plug in Todd Trosclair, you know, dozens upon dozens of LLCs, you know, registered in his name. And then it just becomes this painstaking process of copying and pasting that LLC, bringing it back to the ethics, the Louisiana ethics page, and searching for contributions made in that company's name. And so you just do this over and over and over again until you get a pretty solid list. And then there's, you know, we found some donations, you know, other places too. You can also, you know, one other thing you can do is you can search for all contributions to Cantrell and Action New Orleans PAC, right? And you can download that off the website, off the ethics website, into one giant Excel sheet. So once you have that, right, we were talking about looking at all these LLCs. After you get the huge Excel sheet, you can start looking by addresses, right? Okay, so this is where Todd Trosclair lives. This is the address that he donates from. Okay, what other donations have come from that address? Okay, and then once you see, okay, well, this company seems to be domiciled at the same address, and then you can look into that company to see if there's any connection. So, you know, it's a lot of shots in the dark, and you know, again, just a lot of really monotonous copying and pasting, control F searching. But you know, it over time you can find a lot.
In a nutshell, remind people of what you found in terms of how much money was coming from the developers and affiliated companies.
Right. Yeah. And before we get, I just want to, one thing that, you know, Charles Maldonado, the editor of The Lens, you know, has always said, and something that always struck me is that, you know, there might be a public perception that there's things that journalists can do and obtain that everyone else can't. And just want to make clear that that's not the case. Every tool we're using is, you know, available to every single Louisiana resident. And if there's anything you are interested in, I really encourage you to reach out. My email's on our website. I have, you know, Twitter and everything like that. But back to your question, we ended up finding just under 70,000. Actually, after the piece came out, we found another 2,500. So turns out a little over 70,000 from these developers to the Cantrell administration. Also important to note that some of those contributions came after the collapse. So about 1 month after the Hard Rock collapse, Todd Trosclair, one of the partners, he donated event space and catering to an Action New Orleans PAC fundraising event. And one of his LLCs donated $7,500 on the same day. So the timing there does not, you know, look ideal, at least.
To the best of our knowledge, the depth of your reporting on this, these are not illegal contributions. These were fully reported to the state.
Right. They're not illegal, and they're not even out of the ordinary. Campaign contributions, you know, come from a wide range of industries and individuals. That's just part of the, you know, U.S. political system. And you can object to the overall system. But within that, this is not particularly strange. The other thing to note here is that these are not the only developers donating to the Cantrell campaign and her PAC. And so I had reached out to three professors from three different local universities here, just to try and put that number in context. You know, $70,000 sure sounds like a lot, but what does that actually mean in terms of influencing the decisions of a mayor? That's an entirely different piece here. And one thing that was noted by you know, two of the professors is that big developers of big downtown developments, big luxury condos, mixed use developments in the CBD are all donating to Cantrell, are all making big contributions. And so this also raises a question about whether, you know, these campaign contributions were intended, whether they did it or not, whether they were intended to influence Cantrell's decision making, or whether the donations were made because these developers already felt that Cantrell, back when she was running for mayor, would be the most supportive of these big developments downtown. And I think there's evidence to show that she encourages these developments and sees it as a positive thing, you know, for New Orleans and the economy.
she's certainly not the only one receiving some of those contributions from the developers and their affiliates.
Well, yeah, that's actually, yeah, that is true. One thing I should note is that we, you know, among the 2017 mayoral candidates, Cantrell was the only one that we saw contributions for from these specific developers. And you know, it's very possible we missed some, but it appears that at least the Hard Rock developers were focused on the Cantrell administration. They also donated to several council members, both former and current. A lot of those donations came earlier in the decade, back when the development, you know, was still being approved by the city council.
Michael, we have a couple of minutes left, and this is a story that certainly has had a lot of moving parts. For instance, the special meeting called for by the city council was held Wednesday of this week. Tell me what you heard there.
Yeah, so the meeting was specifically to consider a motion that created a committee specifically to hold public hearings on the Hard Rock collapse and the ensuing disaster that followed. And the meeting had followed kind of a week of sparring between the council and the mayor. The mayor, you know, when the council first announced its intention to hold public hearings, the mayor responded pretty immediately and aggressively by saying that there wouldn't be hearings, that the council didn't have a role to play in here, and that hearings could you know, put other aspects of the disaster recovery at risk. So it might scare off demolition companies to work on the demolition, was, you know, one excuse she gave. But the council held strong, and they ended up holding this meeting, creating the committee. And now that committee is going to be holding, you know, a series of hearings that will look at a number of things that involve this case. I think a big focus will be, you know, looking at legislation to improve worker safety in the future. There was also discussion of, you know, looking at what should happen at the Hard Rock site after the demolition happens. You know, should it be redeveloped as another, you know, tourism industry development? You know, there's talks of dedicating it as a civil rights site. It where the Hard Rock was being built was the site of Woolworth's, where the first lunch counter sit-ins happened in 1960 during the civil rights era. So there was talk of making a dedication to that there, perhaps. So, you know, there's going to be a lot on the plate, and you know, we'll obviously be at all those meetings to tell you what's happening.
Michael, excellent work as always. Michael Isaac Stein, reporting for The Lens. I thank you.
Thank you.
We'll have more on the Hard Rock Hotel disaster later in this podcast.
Some local parents are raising concerns about gifted education programs, or the lack thereof, in some New Orleans charter schools. Lens reporter Marta Jusen has details on this in a story going on The Lens Friday afternoon.
Gifted is a classification that a student may receive after being evaluated by a professional. If you are found to be a student who is gifted, that means you're able to receive additional academic programming and advanced programming.
So state law, if I understand your reporting correctly, it requires gifted education programs at schools, but charter schools are exempted. Explain what that's all about.
Yeah, so Louisiana state law requires schools to offer gifted education programs to any student who has that classification. Louisiana is fairly unique, I understand, in that it protects gifted education similar to the way it protects special education. So that is good news for gifted students. But the gifted students who are in traditional schools, because in charter schools, they are exempted from that law when it comes to the gifted children. They still have to follow special education rules, but they do not have to provide gifted education.
So basically, unless it's written in the charter, in the contract with the local school governing board, they don't have to offer gifted education programs. They're not legally required in that case.
Right. And charter schools don't even have to do the first step for kids. They don't even have to evaluate for gifted. If a parent requests that, they don't have to do it. This is part of that whole school of thought behind charters, which is that, you know, they were to be freed from traditional bureaucracy and red tape, so they wouldn't be required to do certain things. And basically what our charter law looks like is basically a giant set of laws that, you know, schools must adhere to. And those are the kind of basic laws, like, you know, employees must have background checks and, you know, there must be like fire safety equipment. Like, they really are kind of the bare bones of both like student safety and curricular requirements. But charters themselves are free to do, pick their curriculum, hire their staff, pick their programming. Much of that is left to them.
So you examined the situation at Lake Forest Elementary Charter School, one of the few selective admissions schools in the city. What brought Lake Forest to your attention?
A family came to us and they said they had had some questions about the gifted education that their daughter was receiving at Lake Forest Elementary. That's what brought it to our attention. This family, the McClellan family, has been, I would say, advocating for their daughter for quite a long time, and they've been through, it sounds like, ups and downs with the school and how they provide gifted services. As we talked about before, gifted services at a charter school are really left to the charter school themselves. That's what I've found out over this last week of reporting, is that, yes, even if the word gifted is in a charter's contract, it can be pretty vague. And then, you know, their interpretation of gifted does not have to necessarily be the what's required for traditional schools, which in a traditional school would be a, you know, gifted certified teacher, and a gifted student would have to be only taught with other gifted students or pulled out and taught by themselves to meet those gifted service requirements.
Okay, so how did the McClellans feel when they learned this, when they realized this, and what do they do about it?
Well, I'd say they've been fighting for a long time just to kind of get clear answers. You know, when the school changed its model, they weren't really sure if the school was allowed to do that. And it, you know, it's a really interesting position to be put in as a parent. You know, do you really want that traditional model that you think might, you know, lead to better academic outcomes for your daughter? Or do you stay at, you know, one of the better schools in the city, knowing that there's, you know, not a lot of public options out there? So the state has been pretty consistent in their interpretation that, you know, charter schools do not have to provide gifted services. Although we did talk to a civil rights lawyer who disagrees with that and says if the state is going to put gifted services under its umbrella of special education law, then he thinks that parents would have a right to those gifted services. But back to the state, they've been pretty consistent. Charters don't have to provide gifted. If they do provide gifted, it can, you know, be up to their own interpretation. That's also what the Orleans Parish School Board says. They say that, you know, gifted can exist in many forms in their charter schools. Basically, we've asked the district, you know, how they get any teeth behind their charter enforcement if schools aren't outlining this and they are not outlining traditional practices in their How do they have any teeth behind that? And we actually haven't heard the answer to that yet, so I'll keep you posted. Okay. But
Marta Jusen with more excellent reporting on the Education Beat. Thank you very much, Marta.
Thank you.
A quick note about a project we're working on with the higher education nonprofit Open Campus. In coming months, we'll be working with Open Campus to examine how New Orleans colleges can better serve local residents. This initiative is funded in part by a community network grant from the Facebook Journalism Project. Keep an eye out for announcements on neighborhood forums and an online guide that we'll develop to give adults and non-traditional students access to information about higher education. More now on our lead story. A recent essay about the development of the Hard Rock Hotel in a local publication caught our attention. Writer Jules Bentley seemed to capture the angry mood among many residents last month with his criticism of the developers and the local politicians who are responding to the construction site disaster. We wanted to talk with Bentley about his views. I want to read a short excerpt from your essay, Built to Kill, published in Anti-Gravity magazine. What a towering tribute to its enablers the Hard Rock Hotel presents, a great Slumping Sundial, whose gnomon points to their collective moral lodestar, unquenchable greed. It celebrates the greed not just of its developers, but all who collaborated on, encouraged, profited from, and rubber-stamped this death trap. You're not just taking aim at the developers with a statement like that, with a column like this, and not just the mayor, not just her administration.
Yeah, I think that's accurate to say. Also, you know, with the sundial, the pointer doesn't actually point to the sun, and I just want to get out in front of that slightly botched metaphor and say, if you want strict accuracy, you got to read the lens. If you want polemic, come to me. But yeah, that's right. If there was a underlying motivation for this essay besides just the white hot rage that I feel at the injustice perpetrated on the murdered and injured workers, it was to try to contextualize this and to move away from this language of accident and disaster and anomaly, you know, the comparisons to the BP oil spill in 2010 are very ready. That was another example of a tragedy that people in power tried to say it was exceptional. And in fact, my argument is that these kinds of horrors are not exceptional, they're absolutely par for the course. And they're considered the cost of doing business by all the people making money off of them.
And I was a little surprised to find that both you and radio host, former Jefferson Parish Sheriff Newell Normand, arguably on the other end of the political spectrum from you, you were both comparing this scandal to the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster. How do you compare these two incidents in terms of not just the event, but how people in power responded to what happened and the public outcry over these two deadly events?
Well, you know, some of this is in my essay, but I would say, looking now at the aftermath, and I think that Normand repeatedly praising BP on his radio show is very instructive, because actually in the aftermath of the BP disaster, we had, Tony Hayward, actually Stephanie Grace addressed this quite well, I think, in her latest column. We had Tony Hayward, who's the equivalent to Mohan Kailas, you know, in this little comparison. We had the CEO of BP painting himself basically as the victim of this disaster, or as a victim of this disaster. And so we're seeing the same thing, of course, from the developers. A big difference is that in the aftermath of BP, all the people in power got crazy, crazy, crazy money. I mean, BP just threw so much money at all the parish leadership at the state level. You know, everybody with even a little lick of power got a big, fat, green and yellow check, you know. And then also plenty of us working stiffs, you know, people who filed for emergency, whatever. Look, some of that stuff is a little arcane, but BP, they did a good job in protecting their own interests in that regard by just basically dumping piles of bills off of tall buildings all over Baton Rouge and New Orleans, and everybody was busy scrambling for those, and it distracted from just how vicious BP was. So I think a big difference we've seen here is that I don't think Mohan Kailas or the 1031 cronies have greased enough palms. You know, clearly they were very generous with our current mayor, but I think in general we'd be seeing a different response if they were, if 1031 was making it rain the way BP did back in 2010 and 11.
I want to read another short excerpt from your column. I want to get your take on something here. quote, Mayor Cantrell may yet come out strong against the developers who murdered these poor New Orleanians at the Hard Rock Hotel site. But right now, she's actively in cahoots with them. Jules, explain to me why you use the specific term murder here and elsewhere in your writing. Why did you want to use that word? Explain your word choice there.
So, some of your listeners may be shocked to learn I'm not, in fact, a lawyer, although I spend a little more time in court than I'd like to sometimes.
For public disclosure, yes, sir. Yeah, thank you very much.
So the reason I use the term murder is because, to me, the system that this is a piece of is designed to kill us one way or the other. Right. So it doesn't have to be as spectacular as the BP oil disaster or a building collapse. But if you're working 40 hours a week and you can't pay rent in New Orleans, or your entire family's got leukemia from the refinery, that's murder. That's murder. And that's a system that's designed to crush you and to kill you. You know, when I go to Walmart and there's some freaking boomer in their 70s or their 80s, you know, invisible pain, having to work on their feet, they're being killed. They're not just happening to die because things happen to be a certain way. This system that we live under, which is capitalism, I mean, I'll say it, it's the C word, right? It's designed to destroy the working men, women, and children. So when somebody...
You really believe that? Let me just ask. You really believe that, given that the system needs... the system you're describing here needs workers. You're saying that system is, in fact, designed to kill the workers it actually needs to function?
It's designed to use them up. It's designed to use them up. And that's one of the many hundreds of euphemistic ways that we can describe the process of people being killed. It's designed to grind people up. People can disagree with me. I feel like the evidence is on my side. And so that's why when somebody dies in a very sudden and violent and spectacular way as a consequence of the system of greed that's designed to extract value from our bodies, that's why I call it murder.
What do you think needs to be done to stop this sort of thing from happening again?
I'll just say that I'm of the opinion, I think it's worth trying deterrence. So, you know, let's make an example of them and let's see if that inspires, let's just try something new. Let's try some popular accountability measures and see if maybe that has a salubrious deterrent effect, you know, in the tiny teacup that is New Orleans, you know, our little local 1%, they're all the same. And their interests are absolutely the same. And they'll all defend each other. And they all want the same thing. We need to think creatively. And we need to try things that haven't been tried. And honestly, most things haven't been tried because generally the industrialists and the developers just walk all over us. And that's been the history. So, you know, I think, although there have been exceptions, I think it's time to try things that haven't been tried.
Jules Bentley, author and contributor to Anti-Gravity magazine. Jules, thank you very much for your time.
Well, I really appreciate you inviting me. Thank you, and have a great day.
We want to remind you that Jules Bentley's opinions are his own. They do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lens or its staff, and you are most welcome to contribute your own op-ed piece to our community forum. You can email me at twright@thelensnola.org for more information. That's all for this week. I'm your host, Tom Wright. Thank you for getting behind the lens.